Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks, on this Wednesday, January 8th. A somber start to this new year as it begins with death and destruction. Just days after the fire department responded to a deadly fireworks explosion, one of their own died fighting a blaze in a McCully apartment. Thousands of rail riders will be inconvenienced starting Saturday as the rail line service will be halted for the next two weekends. It's for safety reasons as a new stretch of track gets tested. We get the latest on biosecurity and funding asks to fight invasive species from state agricultural officials. And using dyes from nature to make art, how to turn your backyard into paints and inks. And we tip our hat to funny man Frank DeLima as he caps 50 years working with Hawaii Youth. We hanaho some of our recent chats with him. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As we heard in the headlines, four Honolulu firefighters injured responding to a blaze on Yonge Street on Monday have been released after being monitored overnight at Queens Hospital, and they are recovering at home now. Honolulu Fire Chief Sheldon Howe is asking for the public's understanding while his members grieve the death of 25-year-old Jeffrey Fiala, a firefighter who did not survive when part of a roof in the structure they were in collapsed. Chief Howe spoke at a news conference yesterday.
You know, this tragedy is truly heartbreaking for all of us. You know, as firefighters, we know the risks of our job, but, you know, we continue to run towards danger knowing that we are helping people in need. You know, we all train to be our very best, you know, with the goal of ultimately everyone home, getting home safely at the end of the day. And, you know, as you can imagine, that's what makes this very difficult for our HFD Ohana. More on a positive note, the four other firefighters that were injured yesterday evening are planned to be discharged today from Queens, and they'll be going home with their family with their love and support, and also the support from the department. On as they, you know, physically and emotionally heal from this experience. So we will continue to support everyone that has been affected by this event in the hope of honoring Jeff and how he served our community.
And Chief Howe said that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives will begin an investigation into the fire and HFD's response. The loss of the young firefighter came on a day that we dedicated our show to the perspective of our first responders and the risks that they faced in the New Year's Eve fatal fireworks explosion. Four people were killed, three were related, and one of those deaths was of a three-year-old child. Six badly injured victims are being treated at the Arizona Burn Center because Straub's Burn Center has very limited bed space, and there was some concern that had our firefighters needed intensive burn treatment, there would not be enough bed space for them. Our listeners have been weighing in on the New Year's fireworks tragedy. We got this voicemail in our Talkback Line mailbox.
Hi, my name is Steve over in Kihei, Maui, and this is in regard to the fireworks tragedy that's occurred. Coming in late on the show, I just simply wanted to throw in if there was greater enforcement, and this may have been mentioned earlier on, I do not know, but if there was greater enforcement of the sale of these things, that in itself would certainly help a great deal. That's all I got for today, and I'm sorry for all the insanity, loss, and tragedy that's taken place once again this year. I am a 22-year resident here, and this sort of stuff is, as an old gentleman who's now retired, it's causing me to think about just moving on. Mahalo.
We do welcome your feedback. We are planning a live call-in show tomorrow to talk about enforcement and what happens going forward. We plan to hear from Honolulu Police Department and the Department of Law Enforcement. If you have a question or want to weigh in, you can call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us, talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Elon Musk has gotten cozy with Donald Trump and carved out a unique role for himself in Washington. But it's not just U.S. politics he's influencing. He's making waves in Europe, too.
I think the politics he's pushing are incredibly extreme.
Views from Europe about the global influence of the richest man on Earth. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
If you have not heard, the city's rail service will be shut down for 2 weekends starting this Saturday. It was back in the fall on our show that HART CEO Lori Koikina told us that the Skyline service would probably have to be halted in order to test a new stretch of track that runs from Pearl Harbor's Makalapa Gate Station to Middle Street. And this morning, City Transportation Services Director Roger Morton joins us live to talk about all this. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you today?
We are good on this end, but boy, I know you folks are going to be busy because this stands to affect, what, about 2,500 riders?
Yeah, on the weekends, ridership is a little bit less than on the weekdays. In fact, it's about half of what we have on the weekday. So, you know, we had to find a time, and we chose the weekend as the period of least disruption to our customers.
Right, because if you did this in the middle of the week when people are trying to get to work, oh my goodness.
Well, at one point we evaluated a week-long shutdown, but we've come up with a two-day weekend periods.
And so I have to ask, but why are riders just finding out about this now?
Well, we finally made the decision to do this way probably about 2 weeks ago, and you know, if we had made an announcement 2 weeks ago and done most of that, then, you know, our experience is riders sometimes would forget about it if it's too far away from the event. So we made the decision to we actually started notifying people through audio announcements on the vehicles and on the buses about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And we did start getting you know, people responding to that. We also have put up signage that has been, we put it up before our press conference. So, you know, it's a combination of having the press event close enough to the actual event, but still continuing to have outreach with audio announcements on the vehicles and signage at the stations.
So what's the reaction been like from riders as they learn about this?
There's been very little reaction. The worry that we always have is, despite no matter how much we try to do this, that we just don't reach everybody. And, you know, people have lives and they don't necessarily really pay attention sometimes to what's going on. So that's our worry, is that while we're doing our best to try to reach out, that our experience, you know, some people have language difficulties and other issues, and so we're going to be alert for watching what happens on the actual days of.
Well, you know, I imagine, yeah, that folks are going to have to call a cab or a Uber or Lyft or something.
Well, there's bus service, mm-hmm. that the riding public can take, and in our announcements on the web and other places, we list out what those options are too.
Right, but if they're intent on, you know, they just show up Saturday, maybe not knowing, and they got to be somewhere by a certain time, they might have to, you know, act quickly.
They might have to act quickly if they're just, you know, caught off guard totally on the day that it happens. That's correct.
And then tell us about the routes. I mean, have you had to beef up, you know, any additional areas just because of the shutdown?
We think that we probably have adequate service. You know, when we started Skyline in this initial segment, we didn't really pull back on any bus service. So the bus service that's there now was frankly the bus service that was there before we even operated Skyline. So we're pretty confident that we're going to be able to accommodate the loads.
And, you know, I know CEO Lori Koikina, you know, had mentioned that this just has to be done, right? It's just part of the whole safety issue to test the track.
No, it's not. It's really, no. I mean, it's not the track. It's,
well,
it's,
the trains, like, right.
The control system itself. So what is going on is that, as you know, we're operating trains in segment 2 right now, but we're operating them through, at least our contractor Hitachi is operating the trains through a temporary control system that affects only the 4 stations in segment 2. So the what we are going to be doing is we'll be migrating all of the devices, and if you can think of what it's like connecting your phone to different devices in your home, it's somewhat similar, except that we have thousands of devices, switches, lights, gates, ticket vending machines, that all got to connect to an overall system. And that's a complicated effort that requires really careful planning and some time to make sure that we're doing it right. So, and then after we do that, after this 2 shutdowns are over, then our entire segment 1 plus our segment 2 will be operated through the primary control system. And in fact, the trains will through route all the way to Middle Street, although the public will not be allowed to ride on them past Aloha Stadium because the safety aspects have not been certified on the new segment yet.
And then how long do you think will that take before the it's safety certified?
Well, I mean it's up to, it could be faster than what we have planned, and we've been consistent in saying that we would open the system by the end of the year. So the things that have to occur are, there are certain types of testing that have to be done and are being done now, and then there is a 45-day testing process similar to what we went through on the first time to get the final testing and certification done. And we're projecting that to be sometime in the July to October time frame, July, October, November, December. We're not quite sure exactly because it's dependent upon how quickly the boxes are checked on the other things that we're doing right now. So that's what we expect at this point.
Okay. And so you've got these 2 weekends set aside, mm-hmm. But should there be a need for a third weekend? I mean, I guess you'll reevaluate that?
Well, we don't think that there would be a need for a third one. There could be if something goes wrong. And part of the planning of this is if anything is going wrong, which we don't expect, then we need to have within the plan a sufficient time in advance of the end of those 2 weekend periods, each one separately, where we can revert back to the way it was before. Again, that's not the plan, that's not the expectation, but it's part of the what-if planning that we're doing.
Gotcha. Okay. And then I imagine, though, when you do connect over to the city center, then we're going to have to do the same thing again, shut the whole system down?
Yeah, that's something that we've sort of discussed. It's 5-6 years away, so it's a little bit out there. But yeah, that's probably the way. And this has not been, we're not the first system that's had to do this. Some of the other systems around the world have had similar needs to shut down as extensions are added to the system. That was required in Copenhagen. It was required in a few other cities as well.
But I can imagine as the system, gets more accepted by more riders, then a shutdown will obviously then affect more people.
It would. And for when we go into segment 3, that we have already decided at that point, then the planning effort for providing transportation will be more complicated for providing a bus bridge that would mimic the system at that point. At this point, with our ridership to the station being what it is, we don't envision that as a serious thing. But our staff has told me they'll be monitoring that. When something goes wrong with rail, and thankfully there's only been a few instances, but we've had some, that we react in real time to set up a bus bridge to take over that, and normally we can react in a 15 to 20 minute time frame to get something like that. But if going into segment three, you know, that would definitely need to be part of the planning for segment three, would be to have that supplemental already planned and scheduled.
Okay, all right. But, yeah, you just want the riders to know you will be impacted over the next two weekends, and you're going to hopefully get the word out as best you can over the next couple of days.
We're trying to get it all out. I think going beyond the riders that are going to be impacted, and really my apologies to anybody that we impact. This is a milestone for the project, though. This is an indication that, you know, within less than a year, we will have that second segment open.
Okay. All right. We're looking forward to that day. But thank you so much, Roger. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you.
We have been hearing from Roger Morton, Transportation Services Director for the City and County of Honolulu, about the necessary shutdown of the rail system. Skyline will close this weekend and next weekend. It stands to inconvenience about 2,500 riders.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin January 21st. More at olliuhm.org.
Researchers are looking into how the latest virus of avian influenza is making its way to other species.
There is a quarantine zone all around the farm.
We're not testing enough.
We'll get a clear assessment on bird flu right now, how it's changing, and the status on efforts to control it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
The new legislative session kicks off next week, but key budget briefings with lawmakers are in full swing. Today, we take a closer look at a wish list from the State Agriculture Department. Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us today. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so biosecurity at the top of that list?
Yeah, biosecurity has been a main priority of the Department of Agriculture, as well as other state agencies and lawmakers. And lawmakers actually, last legislative session, gave a big infusion of cash, $10 million, to the Ag Department to work on shoring up our biosecurity defenses. And at yesterday's hearing in front of Senate lawmakers, Sharon Hurd, the head of the department, discussed two efforts the department has been working on to fight two of Hawaii's most notorious pets, the first being coconut rhinoceros beetle.
So for the CRB contract, that was awarded to a company called HTM. They're a local company, and what they did in their proposal that was selected for awarding is the Department of Agriculture is going to identify the trees that we have deemed to be dead or dying or no longer viable. And they will be cutting it down, disposing of it, and that's on the islands of Oahu and Kauai. On the island of Oahu, their contract says at least 150 trees. Now, 150 seems like a small number, but it's the 50 feet and higher tree. So that's the most expensive tree to cut down and dispose. So if there's trees that are in the more 30 to 40 foot range, which is the more common, it's going to be cheaper. So we anticipate a greater number than 150, but it's hard to estimate at this time. So that's on Oahu. On the island of Kauai, at least 70 trees will be cut, disposed of properly. And because right now the main problem for CRB, the dead coconut trees, the problems are on Oahu and Kauai, we included the county of Maui and Hawaii Island as more outreach. If they do identify any trees between now and the end of the contract, which is 1 year, they will be cutting down and removing and disposing of those trees as well.
It's just a shame that this pest has spread so far across the state.
Absolutely. And another pest that is really pernicious and has basically taken over Hawaii Island is little fire ant. So the department also has a contract ready to go to treat some residential properties for little fire ant.
For LFA, we're relying on our database that was provided to us of detections. It was collaboration with the ISCS and the Hawaii Ant Lab, as well as our own staff that have identified residential spaces that have either reported or have been detected to have LFA, as well as voluntary reports. And we've gone out there and identified and mapped them and said, okay, these houses have potential issues with LFA. The contractor for this is a local company called Terminix, and they have locations on all islands. So their contract that was awarded in their scope, they're going to treat at least 580 residential properties on the island of Oahu, treat at least 290 residential properties on the island of Hawaii. And right now, the counties of Maui and Kauai would be the same. They're going to treat residential properties within both counties as determined by our plant industry staff as they arise within the course of the scope of a year. So these two major projects, the contracts are ready to go. And so we should be starting service hopefully by the end of the month.
Yes, and we should probably note that Sharon Hurd made a reference to ISCS, and that's the Invasive Species Committee, right, which we have on different islands.
Absolutely. So there's one overarching committee, and then there are councils or different boards that focus on invasive species specific to the islands. So the Little Fire Ant Lab on Hawaii Island, as well as the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, have been doing a lot of work on fire ants as well as other invasive species. And there is money, as you heard Sharon Hood just talking about, going towards invasive species eradication. But as listeners may recall, especially if they've been following HPR Mark Liddow's excellent reporting on this, the Governor Josh Green, actually slashed funding for the bill that lawmakers passed on biosecurity last year. So initially it was supposed to be $20 million. It's now down to $10 million. So some of what the Department of Ag's budget requests that they were presenting to senators yesterday were to get some of that funding back, especially when it comes to issues of personnel as well as aquaculture. But they're not asking for the full $20 million. And one of the things that they didn't build back into their budget request was a couple of million dollars that lawmakers had put in the original bill for public outreach and awareness campaigns on biosecurity and the risk of invasive species. And the decision not to go after that money this year got pushback from Ways and Means Chair Senator Donovan de la Cruz.
The legislature wanted to make sure that the public awareness component, because that's where I think we're having a difficult time, is, you know, you got to have people aware, you got to let them know what to do, give people instruction, who to call, what to look for. That part is missing. Well, so you can be doing all of this, but if the community at large isn't helping us, it's a big fight.
Yes, and unless you get that message across that, you know, these ants are a terrible thing for our environment and our economy, people are not going to be on guard for them.
Yeah, and you can hear Sharon Hurd trying to get a word in edgewise in that bite. And this is something that lawmakers have brought to the attention of the Department of Ag before, and their critique, as with other issues, is they don't feel that the department is being aggressive or proactive enough about concerns related to biosecurity. And that thread carried through a lot of familiar pain points in the hearing yesterday, including something that comes up almost every year, which is electronic ag forms for passengers traveling to Hawaii on planes.
Yes, we do that every time we get on a plane, don't we? Look for the pen or the pencil.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is a program that they're working on. It's called Akamai Arrivals. And the Department of Ag says that passengers on participating airlines may have the option to fill out ag forms digitally as soon as this summer. But the big problem remains, and lawmakers brought this to the department's attention yesterday, is how do you enforce those ad forms? So Jonathan Ho is the head of the Department Ads Plant Quarantine Division, says they actually haven't issued a citation related to an ad form in 15 years. And several of the senators, including Carl Rhodes, says that given the lack of enforcement that we've seen, it's just hard to take those ad forms seriously.
If there's no back-end enforcement, and at least in my experience, there isn't. I mean, I think I've literally gotten off planes and didn't pass the thing in because they never came around to collect it. So I very rarely check bags, so I never go downstairs. And, you know, so that it just, you just walk out of there and there's nothing to stop you from doing it. So that does seem like a major problem. One thing I've learned is being chair of the Judiciary Committee for a long time, it's not the penalty that matters. It's whether you think you're going to get caught. And nobody thinks they're going to get caught in this situation.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah, so that was one thing that they brought to their attention. Another thing that senators were concerned about, specifically Senator Lynn DeCoit, was avian flu. I know you folks in the conversation have been doing a lot of reporting about that on Oahu and the detection on Hawaii Island in wastewater. And she wanted to know how the ad department could be more proactive in making sure that that doesn't get to other islands, specifically Molokai, which she represents. And the ad department responded that it simply isn't feasible for them to ensure that avian influenza is contained to the islands where it's currently been detected because it's circulating in wild bird populations. So it could already be on other islands.
Yes, and I know Molokai is concerned for its egg-laying hens because they've done a great job in providing their own eggs. But, yeah, you don't want to have to destroy those chickens. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been hearing from HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote. She has been monitoring the budget asks for the State Agriculture Department. Avalon Paradea is a Hawaii Island artist who draws inspiration and materials from the natural world and who teaches workshops about how to turn native plants into pigments and dyes, most recently this past weekend at Ward Center. Paradea stopped by our studios before the workshop and spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about the joys of incorporating the natural world into art.
My first segue into working with plant dyes came from doing a workshop that was taught by Kaʻiulani De Silva, who's also a kapa practitioner, amongst other things. It was a full-day thing. It was completely transformative. It was one of those experiences that once I was done with it, I was like, oh, this is going to be the rest of my life, I think, to some extent. You know, and at the time, I was working in conservation with the Koʻola Mountains Watershed Partnership. So that allowed me a chance to be around a lot of native plants and start experimenting with things in my off time. And then when I moved home back to Hawaii Island in 2016, the next year in 2017, met my kumu kapa, Rowan Hufford, and started doing kapa. And so the two things really go hand in hand, is working with the plant dyes as well as making kapa. You know, a lot of the time when I'm harvesting, it can be either out in, you know, so-called more like natural spaces. Sometimes it's a friend's yard. Sometimes it's my own yard. It just depends. But, you know, if it's a plant that I've worked with before, I'm going to know what parts are most useful, how much I need to gather. If it's something that I'm not quite as familiar with, or I've perhaps read about or heard about from other friends, my rule is usually to take just about, you know, a small amount, not so much that it's going to be causing any problems to the plant or anything that needs that plant for sustenance, you know, birds, for example, or insects. Taking that material home and then experimenting. And a lot of the time, it's a matter of figuring out what processes work best. Sometimes it's, you know, you're going to take your plant material and put it on the stove and simmer it for a little while. Sometimes it's as simple as just blending in a blender with a little water. There's been a lot of trial and error, definitely. And it's chemistry at the end of the day. And I've been digging in even more because for me, it's really about the relationality of the pilina that I'm developing as well as what's been developed in the past by Kanaka Maoli for centuries upon centuries. But it's also really fun for me to be getting into the chemistry. And I'm actually hoping to do some collaborative stuff with a chemist this year. So fingers crossed, because I think it'll be fun to better understand how these things work on a chemical level.
Yeah, the idea of putting material in a pot and letting it simmer feels like alchemy.
It is. I feel like I'm doing like the coolest kind of like magic whenever I do this work. It's really fun.
What are some of, you know, the coolest success stories?
I looked at a recipe that was written by Samuel Kamakau, actually, in his book, Napoe Kahiko. And so he was not a kapa practitioner himself. He explains how to work with, basically, there were three different elements. There's hili kukui, which is the dye that you get from the inner bark of the kukui tree. After applying that to your kapa, you are then soaking it in the mud of a lo'i. And so it was pandemic, so I wasn't able to go to a lo'i at the time, but my friends with Hualoha Kiholo were able to give me a bunch of lepo or mud from their the local ia, the fish pond. And so I was able to just bury that like in a bucket. And then after that, take it out and then soak it also in pala'a, which is a native fern. And it was really cool to see it transform in a way that Samuel Kamakau describes. And so it turned into this beautiful like dark brown color, you know, and I'd love to try it again, but it was just this moment of like, I don't know, there's something very special about taking an old recipe and actually executing it successfully.
One of the things that you do as part of your practice, you make art yourself, but then you also teach others how to begin the process of turning natural material into dyes. So what's kind of the 101 that you give them of how to start doing this and why it is cool and important?
No matter what the age group, no matter where I'm doing my workshop, even if it is in the heart of the city, I'm starting with the practice of kilo'aina, which is going into a space that is ideally more outdoors and observing your external and inner environment. And, you know, as I tell people, it's not just your five typical senses of sight, smell, taste, feeling, hearing, but also your na'au and like getting in touch with yourself when you're in a space. And so we usually start off with 10 to 15 minutes of just quiet time. I tell people they can talk story if they want to, but usually just observing. And then we come back together and everybody goes in a circle and shares their observations. And it's really a very grounding experience. And I think that it's really important because we do live in a very, very fast-paced world to remember that when we are doing this kind of work, when we are going into spaces with intention, we need to move slow. It's really important so that we don't make horrible mistakes necessarily when it comes to, you know, I've made mistakes before of, you know, trying to pick off a part of a plant and pulling a whole plant out of the ground when I started this sort of practice, you know, and it's embarrassing and it's a hard way to learn, but it's something that I want to try to mitigate for others if I can. And so starting with that practice, I think, is really foundation setting. And then we move on to talking about the plants that we're working with that day. And then we get hands-on with things. And the last 30 minutes usually is just creative time for people to paint whatever they want. And I love seeing what people do with the dyes at the end of the day.
Thinking of utilizing endemic plants and endemic nature in pigments and dyes, what are some times you've done that? And does it feel differently? Are you thinking of different things when you use that versus a non-native introduced material?
That's a great question. So I do tend to focus more on native and culturally important plants. I do want to start working more actually with non-native and even invasive species because it is important to build relationships with these plants as well. They are here. It's good to put some use to them. But for me, the focus has long been on our native and our indigenous species. And we start with the kilo'aina, but then when we're working with the plants, it's not just, this is mamaki, and we're going to be making our dye with the leaves. It's, let's talk about mamaki and its cultural importance in practices like la'au lapa'au as a blood cleanser, as well as its importance ecologically as a food source for our pulelehua, our kamehameha butterfly, which is endemic. And that is part of the importance of working, especially with endemic species for me, is pointing out how culturally and ecologically important these species are, to not take them for granted, to honor them when we're working with them, to be very careful when we're working with them and harvesting them, but also the identification of these things as well. You know, unfortunately, some of my workshops, I'm not able to bring in like living specimens because I'm just bringing in dried or frozen materials, but providing photographs at the very least, ideally though, cuttings of living material so people can identify these things. At the very least, I always give people a list of resources, books, and websites that they can use to start identifying things because again, what I want is for people to step away from these classes with a newfound curiosity, if not a knowledge base, on how to identify these plants themselves, because it's very exciting to find yourself in a location and suddenly say, hey, I think that's mamaki, and take a photo of it, and sure enough it is, and oh, I was able to identify it. It's like you're able to meet new friends wherever you go, basically. So that's really important to me.
And you brought a couple swatches in.
So these are two swatches, which are examples of some of the inks that I've made. And so the difference between like dyes and inks is, at least in my practice, a dye is going to usually be a water-based extract of the colors of the plant, whereas an ink is the same thing. It's a dye, basically, but then a binder has been added, so a thickening agent. And because I try to be as local and as intentional in my work as I can be, I prefer using Koa sap as a binder, but it's not super accessible for people a lot of the time, and it is a matter of not wanting to cause harm to a Koa tree, of course. So in my workshops, I also show people how to work with gum arabic powder, which is a powder from an acacia tree found in Africa, and Koa is also an acacia tree, so it's basically the same exact thing, and it's inexpensive, easy to find in art supply stores. So you're adding a little bit of that with water and then adding that into your ink to thicken it, basically. So we've got Mamaki Uhaloa, so it's kind of a mix that's like a reddish brown. Olena, which is a really important Polynesian introduced plant, you know, medicinally. So turmeric, a really awesome yellow. Popolo is the leaves of an indigenous plant called Popolo, which gives a really nice green. Ma'o is our endemic cotton, so only found in Hawaii. And the flowers are these super cute little yellow flowers, but they give this incredible forest green. Uki-uki, which I say I don't have favorites, but I will say there's something about uki-uki that just speaks to me. And that is also a native species. And the berries are this beautiful bright blue color, and they give a really lovely grayish blue. And then the stem or the haw of the kalo, that is like a darker color, so the blacks, the reds, those can give this really lovely kind of purplish red, purplish brown color too.
And it really, really is a rainbow. The first adjective that came to mind when I was looking is like, it's such a rustic palette.
Ooh, I love hearing that. Yeah, it is. And so that's another thing that I point out to people too, is working with plant materials, you're usually going to be getting more subdued tones than what you're going to be getting with commercial paints of any sort, whether it's watercolors or acrylics, et cetera. And admittedly, when I first started working with plant dyes, there were moments where I was like, gosh, I really miss like hot pink, you know, like these colors that you do see in nature, you know. I mean, hibiscuses are these beautiful bright pinks in many cases. But if you were to simmer that down, you're going to end up with more like a bluish color or maybe a light red or something, you know. And it's funny, I have really gotten to a point now where I'm not really interested in having those bright colors anymore. Once in a while, I am. But I love what my kumu always says after she makes a piece. Within a few weeks, as she puts it, as Rowan puts it, she's like, I like when they start to calm down, because things can start off really, really bright, and then they start to sort of simmer down a little bit in terms of their color, you know. And that's part of the process too, is the transformation. Plant dyes are constantly changing whatever media you're putting them on. And for some people, that's not ideal, and that's okay. You know, this isn't for everybody. But for myself, the transformation of these elements is really important, because ultimately everything changes, including commercial paints like acrylics that we think of maybe as being more permanent. But I love the honesty that comes from working with plants, and again, the connections that we can make as transformative creatures ourselves. We're never going to stay the same throughout our lifetimes, and neither are these colors once mm-hmm. they've been applied to their media.
What are some just feelings and thoughts you want people to be left with when they leave a workshop with you?
I do want people to feel inspired. You know, I want people to feel unafraid of allowing themselves to be creative. For a long time, I myself was somebody who had trouble with just stepping into my creativity, and I still do a lot of the time, to be honest. But because these materials are not things that you're necessarily going out and paying for, I think there is some freedom once you get to know people growing them, once you're growing them yourself, or you're finding them in a place where you are allowed to harvest them. That's a big part of it, is not just going and picking things willy-nilly, but finding inner inspiration by getting to know these plants better. And I also do want people stepping away that even if they're not going to continue doing the artistic side of this in the future, just being more aware of their surroundings, because even here in the heart of Honolulu, there are so many native plants that are growing all around us. And it's incredible what you start to notice when you are put in a position where you have to notice these things. So I do hope that people walk away from my workshops with newfound creativity in their hearts and a desire to learn more about our Aina and its history mm-hmm. and its future.
That was Avalon Paradeo talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have photos of the native plant dyes and inks and links to the workshops on our conversation page of our website after the show. In this week's Mono Minute, where's that laugh coming from? Well, today we hear the song of a game bird, one called Urkel's Spurfowl or Urkel's Franklin. But if you ask us, its song is really more of a cackle. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo biology professor Patrick Hart.
Urkel's Franklins are plump, partridge-like birds with a distinctive chestnut-colored cap on their head and chestnut-streaked feathers on their chest and back. They're about 16 inches long and weigh a little more than 2 pounds. Originally from the Ethiopia region of Africa, Hawaii is the only other place in the world they're found in the wild, as they were introduced as a game bird here in the 1950s to 60s. They can be seen on Oahu, Kauai, and the Big Island, where they've become very common, especially in higher elevation grasslands and shrublands. If you hear a loud, laughing cackle, but there's no people around, there's a good chance there's an Urkel's Franklin nearby. Urkel's Franklins are similar to chickens in that they spend most of their time on the ground and also prefer to run rather than fly. Also like chickens, the females lay a large clutch of eggs in a nest on the ground. And when the young hatch, they're already covered with feathers and are ready to forage on their own. A recent study from Oahu showed that they love to consume a variety of fruits from both native and non-native plant species, and are likely spreading a variety of invasive plants such as vivee, blackberry, and clydemia into our native forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
You know, this weekend, a local comedian, Frank DeLima, took the stage to mark the end of a 50-year run working with children in schools as part of his nonprofit, the Student Enrichment Program. The show at the Hawaii Theater featured local comics Augie T., Paul Ogata, and Andy Bumatai. And we just love Frank DeLima's work, and we thought it would be fitting to look back on a few times that DeLima has graced us with his appearance and musical parodies on The Conversation. Who could forget his trying to make light of pandemic restrictions?
Make me look fine, that's all I ask. Mask maker, it's the new look. Please make me a perfect mask. Mask maker, what get for sale? Show me in Zoom, all in detail. Make me a style that helps me breathe clear and doesn't pull off my ear.
And here is how DeLima explained comedy in Hawaii in his creative process back in 2021.
Aloha, this is Frank De Lima, and I'd like to talk story a little bit about humor in Hawaii. And I believe it came from the plantation days and the fact that we have so many ethnic groups that had come here to Hawaii to live. And eventually, they're going to start meeting each other. And, you know, from there, they get to know each other. And there's always going to be the imitators, no matter what group you are part of, you know, no matter family or friend or whatever it may be, there's going to be the comedians. Even though they're not professional, they would still be comedians. You know that. You know, a lot of people know that family member or a friend is very funny. And that happened way back. That's human nature. And a lot of the humor comes from imitating or recognizing colloquialisms and phraseologies, and they pick it up and then they imitate it and they put it into skits, into funny skits and jokes. And one of the things about jokes is that the punchline, you know, you have to be creative to do that kind of stuff. And there are people out there that have the imagination that does that stuff. And if this will happen, I'm one of them. And so is all the other comedians that exist in our world. But comedy is mirroring true life. And so it's important that if you want to get into comedy professionally, then you're going to have to understand that whatever jokes you tell and whatever skits you do and whatever imitations you do, you'll have to expect someone or a group or whatever it may be that may not like it. But that's part of being a professional comedian. It comes with the territory because, you know, it's mirroring society, mirroring people. But if you're non-professional, then the best thing to do, and this is what I tell the kids, I say, go up and ask the person first, would you like to be entertained? And would you like to hear a joke? And you tell them what it's about, okay? People like jokes, but they don't like all jokes. So, you know, you tell them, hey, you want to hear a joke about a cow? You get time. You can hear a joke about a cow. And the person, no, I don't like jokes about cows. I said, oh, okay. How about an elephant? Yeah. I like jokes about elephant. Then you tell them the joke. Or you just move on and find someone that has that type of humor. So it's important that we laugh. That's the main thing. And we just find where we can get that material to help us to laugh. And just look through all the different types of comedy and find the one you like. And the ones you don't like, just let other people who may like it enjoy it. You just enjoy yours. Let other people enjoy theirs. And that's what makes life much easier and fun.
And remember his parody on impeachment proceedings?
Impeachment, the news went out to me. 12, Ukraine, we all gave a migraine. 11, obstruction. 10, she said she heard, he said. 9, they said he said what he said. 8, I don't know what he said. 7, I assume that's what he said. 6, I'm not sure he said what he said. 5, quid pro quo. 4, long-winded lawyers. 3, prim professors. 2, doubtful diplomats. And 1, whistleblower that we all know can see.
And we spoke to him back in February 2021.
I DVR things, you know, and because there's always possibilities of parodies coming that develop along the way. And so I DVR'd all those sessions.
Oh, wow.
and I watched them. Sometimes I sped it up when they were asking the same question again the next day, you know. But what I gathered is what I put on the song in a light, just to lighten things up, and that's what I do with parodies. I decide which ones can be lightened and which ones cannot, and so
this is how what I came up with. I came up with at the end, the 12th day of Christmas, is it. It developed us of Ukraine, Ukraine, we gain migraine. Because of all of this back and forth and question and all of that stuff. I said,
it was hours of hearings.
Yes.
So how long did it take you to write the song?
That was a couple hours, and then I recorded it, but I didn't like it. The way it was too boring. So I changed it, and I put in what she said, he said, they said, and all that kind of stuff. And it sounded better. So that's the one that I gave to the radio station.
So describe the creative process. I mean, so you put this together, you know, you say you didn't really like it. It wasn't quite right. So then do you just, like, let other people listen to it and give their 2 cents?
What I do is I rewrite it. And then I share it, and then I say, well, maybe could you tweak this one? I have a good friend, Patrick.
Patrick Downs. He's wonderful.
So he helps me to tweak things, and sometimes he comes up with the song. You know, it all depends. And so more recently, though, that I've been this kind of doing it myself and then getting him to help me to tweak. And so that's what I came up with.
Well, you know, Lima tells us he may not give up playing with parody, so if he gets inspired in his so-called retirement to create a song or two, we're looking forward to it. And Lima left the door open for appearing on stage again. He just wants to take a break and take it easier as he ages, which is something he's even used as song parody material. Take a listen to 76 Hormones in our interview with him in 2021.
76 hormones give me plenty stress, with 110 aches and pains close at hand. That followed by lumbago, sciatica, and vertigo. So grab a cane and let's get on with the show.
Well, I was talking to my friend David Alisman, and he was, you know, he's been having backaches and operations for his shoulder and for all kinds of stuff for a long time. And so I said, well, David, aches and pains come with all of us, but I really am not envying you with all that you have. And I said, then is your birthday coming up? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm going to make 76. And I started singing, 76 hormones give me plenty stress. And he just cracked up laughing for almost 5 minutes. He and I both started. I said, well, that's a good song. And so he send me a couple of lines to continue, and then that meant he wanted me to finish the rest. I didn't know it was that long, the song, but I got enough aches and pains to be able to do it.
Okay, you can relate.
So, yeah, I can relate. You know, from the head to the toe, oh my goodness, when you get older. So that's the inspiration of that song, and that's it.
And that was comedian Frank DeLima talking to us over the years, and so we salute him as he takes it a little bit easier in his old age.
Ho'okahi Sunday afternoon, there goes my coo-toot-toot-toot-toot-toot-e. She's riding the cab to town. She wouldn't travel any other way.
Okay, we're out of time, but up tomorrow, we will open our phone lines to talk about fireworks enforcement. HPD Brass and the state's law enforcement director will join us. Got questions? Record something on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.